In this episode, I am joined by Marc-Emmanuel Dumas. Together, we discuss how metabolites are the messengers of the microbiome towards the host, the added value of investigating multiple measures of the phenotype in the context of liver disease, and how machine learning and AI will impact the field in the near future. Listen in on this episode and don't forget to connect on LinkedIn to continue the conversation that will start today with Marc-Emmanuel Dumas. Welcome back to The Metabolomist for a third season, where we will dive into the concrete applications of metabolomics and where this tool will impact society in the next 5 to 10 years. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I am joined by a diverse group of scientists, medical doctors and other professionals who have used metabolomics and pushed it beyond just descriptive studies and towards applications that will or are already impacting people's lives. This year, the keyword is really impact. Like you, I know the potential of metabolomics. In the last two seasons, I've discussed with many metabolomists about how powerful, sensitive, and informative metabolomics can be. But this year, I want to zoom in on the impact, the applications that are or soon will be changing our lives for the better. Welcome back to The Metabolomist. Today, my guest is Marc-Emmanuel Dumas. Welcome.
Hello.
So today is a very special episode for several reasons. First and foremost, it's the first time that I'm sitting in the same room as my guest. We usually do this over Zoom, but today we're sitting together and we're also recording this from the Metabolomic Society meeting in Osaka. And of course, it's special because Marc-Emmanuel is our guest today. You work at Imperial College London. And also, you're also affiliated to the CNRS in France. Do you want to quickly introduce your work? And I really liked the way that you introduced yourself yesterday. I don't know if you want to reuse this, but please just explain to whoever doesn't know you yet what your work is about.
Yes, so Marc Dumas, I'm working at Imperial College London as chair in systems medicine. I'm also director of research at CNRS, the French National Center for Scientific Research. And I've been working in metabolomics over the last 25 years. It's a bit like Obelix. I fell into the cauldron when I was little. And clearly, it's been quite an adventure working in this field.
Yeah, you started metabolomics a bit at the time when metabolomics started, didn't you? And in one of the groups that was really driving this.
I did my PhD in France. It was with Alain Paris, who's one of the founders of that area of research in France. And obviously, that was at a time where the founding fathers of metabolomics were getting their papers out at the same time. So it was a huge inspiration for us and for myself during my PhD. Then, yes, I moved to Imperial for a postdoc. That was in 2002. And then for me, this is when everything's changed because I was at the right place at the right time and in the right project. And that really allowed me to make some big changes in the way I worked and in the type of papers I was publishing. And that kind of set me up for the rest of my career.
Yeah. And I think you started really on the methodology and then went a bit to the biological aspects a bit later.
Yes, that postdoc that was with Jeremy Nicholson at the time. I think, when you start your career, there's different focus you can have, but very clearly in highly technological fields, I think your attention is naturally drawn towards how they're doing it. You read the papers, you read the methods section, and you're just dissecting that part first. And then as you gain more experience, you focus more about the scientific question, and then you focus more about your focus shifts to the results and the discussion and the abstract more than just getting to grips with the technology.
Does that mean that you feel like you've solved the technological problems?
I don't think it's... No, and I mean, it's work in progress.
It's a joke.
It's one of these big change in perspective that I've experienced. And I mean, it came in naturally because of looking at what we were doing at the time. So looking for a signature for insulin resistance, we kept seeing lots of microbial metabolites. So that was back in the early 2000s. And at that time, the microbiome field wasn't as popular as now. Mm-hmm. We saw the tide turn with the attention and the focus changing from looking at purely intrinsic factors. So, you know, diabetes doctors looking for molecules and genes causing diabetes, but clearly human genes or human molecules involved in diabetes. And very quickly, within the space of 2 years, we saw these very same collaborators changing their mind and all of a sudden realizing that the microbiome might well be part of the message. At the beginning, we had some very very interesting comments about the fact that our samples had degraded and then we should know better.
Well, then but it was the bacterial contamination
exactly,
of your samples.
Exactly, yes, exactly. Sometimes you can come across with a correct message, but if you're using a technology that people don't necessarily understand, at the time metabolomics wasn't that well known, you're rowing against the flow. And clearly, this took a couple of years so that others using genomic methods were starting to say that actually look at bacteria are important.
It was a big and dogma shift in a way.
Exactly. From then, it's been a heck of a ride. Microbiome field.
Yeah.
With lots of very interesting work, interesting collaborations, lots of projects with lots of very interesting people.
In your work now, you end up combining microbiomes or metagenomics or microbiome research together with metabolomics and other omics. We will see in the paper we discuss its multiple omics. But is there a particular link between microbiome research and metabolomics that makes these omics very significant in that field?
There's a strong incentive to bring metabolomics. Metagenomics, and especially now with shotgun metagenomics, you get a wealth of information about the species and even the genes. But really, if you think that the microbiome is playing the role, then you might as well want to get the messengers. Our thinking is that microbial metabolites are the messengers in that crosstalk between the microbiome and the host. So once you have a metabolite, it could be a marker, but it could be bringing a mechanism. And if you have a mechanism, then you're into causality. And at the moment, that's what the field needs. There's been a lot of hype in the microbiome world, from total deep belief at the beginning to now everybody being super excited and interested in the microbiome.
Everything today.
Well, the effect sizes are absolutely huge.
Yeah.
But behind the effect sizes are also the confounders. So there's two key challenges at the moment in microbiome sciences. Then one is disentangling the signal from the confounders, and then the other one is moving from association to causation, and mechanisms are definitely one key way to make that jump.
And going back to one point you just made before, a couple of days ago I posted something on LinkedIn that was mildly controversial, where I was recommended. So I'm always interested in the effect on the host. Looking at microbiome. This is the thing I'm interested in. There are other ways to look at microbiome, of course, but if you think of studying the effect on the host, do you see a point for measuring metabolomics in feces versus plasma versus urine? In the paper, we'll discuss only plasma and urine. But my point that I was making is that it may be more relevant to look directly in plasma for the microbial metabolites and their derivatives and so on, rather than to look in feces, because these would be the metabolites that actually were absorbed by the host. What's your perspective on this? I'm sure it's not black and white, huh?
I'm not sure that's so controversial, but we'll see. If you're getting metagenomic, then obviously from fecal samples, it's really tempting to look into the fecal material. But like exactly the point you made is that actually in feces, we might see wonderful associations with the makeup of the microbiome by the time it reaches that stage and is being excreted as feces. But like you said, the metabolites get absorbed. So they end up in the bloodstream and then further down the line in urine. Obviously, we are looking at, in clinical studies, we tend to look mostly at biofluids. They're much easier to sample. There's very little psychological barrier in getting those samples. With fecal material, there is a lot more thinking and logistics and also pedagogy to go into the clinical recruitment to convince people to contribute a sample. If we're going back to the notion of these microbial metabolites playing an active role and having a mechanism that support not only the association, but also the mediation that we're observing at a statistical point of view. If there is a mechanism that there's most likely a pharmacological target behind, and all of a sudden then we're discussing pharmacology or microbial metabolites. No, they're not drugs, but they are natural products. But they're operating with the same rules, so absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. So clearly, you're going to look at these two biofluids, plasma and urine, and you're going to see lots of variation in those. For the metabolites to have an effect on distant organs, then it has to go through systemic circulation, and the concentration need to be high enough that they're going to hit one of those pharmacological targets. I mean, they're not pharmacological targets, they're signaling targets.
Yeah.
We're not talking about drugs, we're talking about natural products and metabolites here, but
they could be.
You need increased plasma concentrations of those, and this is when things are becoming interesting, because plasma is actually highly regulated by liver metabolism, but by transporters in various interfaces, whether it's the gut or whether it's the kidney. So you have to hit pretty hard to change plasma concentration. In tox studies, where if you try a new test compound, then you end up with huge variation in urine that has nothing to do. These concentrations have nothing to do with the scale or variations in plasma. So if you're looking for a culprit, a guilty culprit, then biofluids and especially urine would be ideal. Urine is a bit more difficult to, again, there are a few barriers at getting urine compared to getting plasma. So what most clinical studies have is access to plasma. But if you're asking what people would like to look at, we actually have urine and fecal material. And I think, you know, each one of them will provide you with a slightly different viewpoint and characterization of the samples in the system.
And it's really interesting because then you really start to look at different compartments through these different sample types. And I think in the paper we're going to discuss next, these sample types were used separately, but do you sometimes theorize on where the analytes go, where the metabolites go, and where they're concentrated and what that could mean?
We are trying to, but that's not easy.
You need a lot of mathematical models in the background.
So for a long time, I have been chasing this idea that systems biology would solve everything, but then I came to realize that I wasn't good enough at this. Now I'm revising my ambitions and I'm being much more pragmatic. And learning the data is important. So learning what each data set has to say is a pretty good way of starting to build a picture. Obviously, you need to put the pieces of the puzzle together. I mean, it's a technology that a lot of people use, and even at this conference. But clearly, the different pieces of the puzzle, the different omics, there's multiple ways you can integrate those. The simple way, what I find simple, but maybe for different researchers it will be different, but the way I find relatively easy for me is statistical integration. I'm thinking in multivariate statistics, you're kind of drawn naturally to do this kind of analysis.
Yeah. But
these remain inherently correlative analysis. It's univariate or multivariate. It doesn't really matter that much.
But it's a starting point for further thinking.
The next level up is actually knowledge integration. And this is when your initial training as a biologist kicks in, because then you're making connections between this and that based on what you know about the pathology, about the pathways, and about the integrative physiology. Then the really tricky level is this knowledge. I mean, it took you years of formal training to get this knowledge. Can you capture this from various types of biomedical resources, biological, databases, and so on, and integrating those? This is where I found that I was not performing as other people would, and clearly I've been more drawn into this data integration.
So this is where the collaborations kick in. So this is where work with other people who do that well.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is where the collaborators kick in. This is where the various tools and resources that are available kick in. We've been looking at, I mean, obviously in metabolomics, you look at metabolic networks. That's the first port of call. But then then you realize if you're looking into signaling mechanisms, and maybe you should put signaling pathways as well. So signaling pathways, there's typically receptors, and then there's transduction signal across the cell. You end up on a transcription factor that's going to create the expression of the genes. And very quickly it becomes complicated. So we try to rationalize these things with very pragmatic ways of looking at things, and you have lots of assumptions that are probably not met, but then it's highly informative into what could happen. One of the things we tried to do in this paper was to integrate transcriptomics, so the paper. So since we are talking about this paper,
So I will introduce it, because I think in what we discussed in the introduction, we really introduced a lot of the topics that are in this paper. The paper is entitled Molecular Phenomics and Metagenomics of Hepatic Steatosis in Non-Diabetic Obese Women, published in Nature Medicine. It's from 2018. And the first authors, there are three first authors, right? I think they share the first authorship. So Leslie Hoyles is the first author. And then there's Jose Manuel Fernandez Real and Massimo Federici. So very international group, apparently. To introduce it quickly, so you're looking indeed at hepatic steatosis in women, in obese women. And you're using several omics. This is a good point, I think, to introduce the different materials and omics that you used. So you have the metagenomics from feces, you have liver transcriptome from the liver tissue, and then the metabolome from the plasma and the urine, and then all the clinical parameters that you have about these patients. And so do you want to tell us a bit maybe about what you were looking for in this study and maybe some of the main findings? Then we can go in a bit more detail.
Sure. So this paper was, it is an international team because it was based on a European project, which was called Florinash, which was led by Rémi Bursola as the coordinator of the FIU project. We have several courses because we really needed all the expertise together in order to look into this. So the question we were asking in this consortium was, you know, Florinash, you know, it's already telling what the purpose was. So that was the role of the microbiome in fatty liver disease. So now the names have changed. So now we're not calling it NASH anymore. It's MASLD or MASH. And then obviously this is not the gut flora. They're not flowers. But that was a catchy acronym. What we looked into is trying to identify a signature from the microbiome for fatty liver disease, metabolically associated steatosis.
Yes.
And we found some amazing associations. And one of the key results of the paper is that there was this notion of a collapse in the diversity, the gene diversity and the richness of the genes in obesity. So this is something that our colleagues in MetaHit had published for obesity. And with Leslie, who was a research fellow with us at the time, she completely re-implemented all the metagenomics workflows in my lab. And we were looking at this gene richness paper that was published a few years before. And we were like, but is it really working? I mean, we were wondering if it would hold. And to much of our surprise, it worked beautifully in our paper. And then we saw that not only when our waistlines expand, but when our liver accumulates fat, and then it's associated with a drop in gene richness. And this in itself was already a wonderful result.
Yep.
Then what we did, we looked into the metabolomics and the metabolomics of the biofluids, so plasma and urine by NMR. And we looked also into the transcriptomics of the livers of these patients. We had a small set of patients, and because of various reasons, including the difficulty to keep the groups balanced according to sex, then we basically had to focus on the women who were recruited to that study. One of the challenges in statistics is to make sure your groups are balanced. And we were struggling to see the recruit to have enough recruitment for healthy males in the study. So we essentially focused on the women, and I think this is one of the key aspects of the paper, that what we found here is that this is CONAP in gene richness. We found a few metabolites that were seemingly associated positively with fatty liver disease or negatively.
Yeah.
And then we tested those metabolites and we tested those associations and we tested the role of the microbiome using what we call experimental causality. That's a clever way of saying going back to the bench.
Yeah.
We did a few experiments. Obviously, my group didn't do everything.
Mm.
That's why you have so many people on the paper. But the fecal microbiota transplantation were done by Rémy Bursonnet's group.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed amazingly that with fecal microbiota transplants from human donors, you could, within 2 weeks, modulate fat content in the liver of those mice. And the thing that completely blew my mind is that the microbial makeup in the stools highly predictive
mm-hmm.
of the liver content in the mice. The stools were collected years before the mice were born, and still you could predict what happened to the liver of these mice. That was clearly one of the key moments in that paper. The second key moment after that, it's probably the third key moment by that, was to show that one of these metabolites, phenylacetate, was actually showing some causality
mm-hmm.
in experiments in primary human hepatocytes.
Mm-hmm.
So in short, the metabolite increases lipid accumulation in the hepatocytes, but also in mice who were gavaged with the metabolite. So that's a lot of experiments, and that was a bit of a mad rush to get all these experiments done. But the paper itself took the best part of 7 or 8 years.
I get because it's a very rich paper. As you said, it really starts from the cohorts of a certain size, and then you plan which omics you're going to use, and based on the results, you plan the follow-up experiments. And I mean, it's with the follow-up experiments that you really bring in the causality and the better understanding of what's happening. But one thing, even just in the first figure, I found it really interesting in figure 1F. So you look at the shared variance between the different groups of data sets that you have. And I mean, I find it really almost entertaining that the clinical parameters are the ones that are least associated with the other data sets. Is it, you think, because it just has fewer features in it and it's not as flexible as the others? Or do omics really bring something that is new compared to the way that we used to look at the phenotype of someone with disease?
So when we look at clinical parameters, bioclinical variables, I mean, these are the accepted, they're not biomarkers, but these are the accepted markers that our clinical colleagues use every day. And these have been selected through years and years and years of thorough work.
Mm-hmm.
But most of these were actually identified before the omics data revolution. So what?
Mm-hmm. I
tend to think that it's the second part of your statement that might be true, that no matter how good the clinical parameters are, then with these multi-omic studies, then we find a lot of very interesting variables that when they are harnessed together in whether it's linear model or non-linear model, now we call that machine learning, these are actually highly predictive.
Yeah.
And then we've seen that in several studies that when you harness multi-omic data, you end up classification power that is often overperforming the well-accepted clinical scores. I mean, the ground truth is the clinical scores.
Of course, always saying how we've defined diseases, but the markers, so those markers also existed before some of these diseases existed. So maybe there is a place there for new markers or for more refined markers that tell us more. I think it's interesting also the progression of the paper. So at the beginning, the microbiome changes are well related to the omics, but not so much to the clinical parameters. But then if you consider the FMT convinces you that there's a causal link there, then whatever is better linked to the microbial changes also would be maybe a very interesting source of biomarkers. I mean, it's not crazy to think that way.
So, no, absolutely not.
and this is actually the last figure as well.
Fire. But what's in a biomarker?
Mm-hmm.
I think in the cancer field, a biomarker is actually something that has gone through an extremely thorough process of validation. in the metabolic diseases, I think we use it a bit more loosely. I think behind the marker is finding the mechanism and moving towards the mechanism, which is complicated because you can stop there and write a beautiful paper with a beautiful discussion. And then if you want to identify these mechanisms, then it's many more years of hard work and it's different types of experiments. It's a lot more, I call it functional metabolomics, but you go back to the bench and end up doing a lot of experiments to demonstrate the role played by this metabolite.
Yes.
I think other people might call it molecular metabolism and so on. This is one of the key challenges today, moving from association to causation. Mm. Otherwise, associations, I mean, they're beautiful, but they're still a little bit in the air.
Yeah. But so you still feel
they
like...
Remain a little bit.
You finished the paper with building predictive models that also go into this direction of using the different layers of omics. You see that basically what you call the phenome, so the combination, if I got it right, of the transcriptomics and the metabolomics together, so those more reactive omics, that's what the phenome is in that paper, I think. So adding those together, this is how you get the best AUC and the best prediction of the steatosis state.
Yes,
it's right. Nice results.
We used all the omics data, so metabolomics, transcriptomics, and metagenomics.
Also,
but
okay.
I think, doesn't matter. I think the idea is clearly to combine all these omics. It's one of the questions we often get. Okay, that's nice for Touchon, but how useful is it? What can you tell us about it? Can you build a linear model, a machine learning model to tell us what's going to happen next?
Of course. And who's develop steatosis in 5 years instead of diagnosing them today?
Like, exactly. Yeah. So who's going to develop steatosis in 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
And also, why is this person with obesity developing steatosis when this other person who's getting the exactly same BMI doesn't? So some people are, I wouldn't say protected, but some people do not develop steatosis, whereas others do.
Is it because they hit their greens, you think?
Well, depends who you talk to. There's actually some polymorphisms that are involved for that. But even when you correct for those, and it happens sometimes that we do this, there's actually an awful lot that's happening. So the microbiome plays a role. Obviously, nutrition plays a role. And most of these microbial metabolites that we're looking at, to some degree, because we're looking at gut microbial metabolite, their origin is in the food we eat. But the functionality of the microbiome is clearly one of the key determinants to make the link between the diet, the microbiome, its metabolic output, and the host phenotype. I like to talk in terms of axis. So we are working on this diet, microbiome, metabolome, and immune axis, and we have another project when we're looking at this axis and how we treat it. And our hypothesis is that it's underpinning the transition from health to disease. It depends which way you look at it, but that could be developing disease or that could be actually promoting health, depending on which way you look at things. So we are very keen on all these multi-omic studies, whether it's precision medicine, precision nutrition, precision immunology. So these microbial metabolites play multiple roles, have multiple functions, and clearly it's been fun looking at those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you make really interesting stories out of this, I have to say. This year in the podcast, I focus on the impact of metabolomics. So I ask each one of my guests, where do you see the main impact of this specific omic in the next 5 to 10 years? Like, where do you see it really impacting the lives of people? In the end, do you see something like that?
Well, I think you can. Yes, absolutely. The key thing about metabolomics is that people have been doing it for decades, even before it was called metabolomics. And some of the clinical markers we were talking about earlier are measured by what we call now metabolomics. So I think the case is actually well settled now. Where is it going next? I think with metabolomics, now we have the tools to be able to monitor not only nutritional exposure, the exposome, but also whether people take their drugs, their medication correctly, and so on. And I mean, sometimes people make mistakes, sometimes they forget to take them drugs. But there's also other factors like the pharmacokinetics. You know, are people fast metabolizers or slow metabolizers for such and such drug? And then we can tie all of this to the outcomes, to the clinical outcomes, and to the response to therapy. So one of the key developments, I think, in the next few years will be this increased use of machine learning and AI models to model metabolism and model these metabolic trajectories more efficiently. And I think the second one would be harnessing AI to actually decipher the crosstalk between the host and the microbiome with these metabolites. Now we just started lifting the curtain, and then from what we see, and then there's lots of these metabolites will have bioactivity. They have lots of receptors. We're starting to talk about kinases as well. So there's lots of signaling targets that are modulated 24/7 by these metabolites. We are being dosed by friendly bacteria, not just a bacteria, or friendly gut microbes with those metabolites 24/7, and it's bound to regulate human physiology and pathophysiology and the response to drugs. So clearly, that would be one of the challenges that I'd like to push. I'd like the others to push, but I won't be able to do that myself as well, just by myself. But
On both fronts, both the kind of personalized medicine and the other one more focused on modulating the microbiome, are the hurdles mostly technological? Like, do we need the second one? Maybe more, like we still need to understand the tools and grow the tools. But I guess there are hurdles also from the outside of just the scientific field that we discussed a bit before. The complexity of let's say validating biomarkers, for example, is something that I've discussed with other guests this season as well. So they have to put a lot of effort into validating their results with different cohorts and so on. Do you have any perspective on this?
Well, we do validate our observations one way or another. So whether it's through independent replication in another cohort, or whether we are trying to perform validations in what we call preclinical models, or whether it's cells, animal models, or organoids or organ chips. It boils down to triangulating your evidence. So you need multiple ways of demonstrating the same effect. And then when one way of observing this effect, most people wouldn't consider as being sufficient. So you need at least two or three different ways of looking at the same problem to find the same answer. So to make sure that, yes, that's what the field recognizes as a sufficient evidence. So yes, there are challenges. There are data sets that do not have any equivalent. So it's difficult to pick up the phone and call one of your friends for a replication. And sometimes the preclinical models do not allow you to replicate what you see in humans. So there's a bit of a gray area sometimes. This is where we can harness, you know, the power of machine learning models and AI so that we can sieve through these hypotheses, so that the ones we put forward for validation are actually the ones that probably have the highest chances of success. But that is easier said than done.
So we've discussed a lot. I think we've covered a lot of ground. Are there any additional thoughts you would like to bring up before we get to the final question? Anything else you want our listeners to get? They are home already, probably, but to stay home with on the topic of microbiome and metabolomics?
Well, I think that's this idea that these metabolites are, well, I've said it already, so that's not one last thought, but clearly hanging on to that thought that microbial metabolites are the messengers. They're not just building blocks. They are also the messengers.
Yeah.
This is an idea that I keep on pushing. Others are pushing it too. I'm not the only one, but that's what I'd like to be focusing on over the next few.
Yeah, this is why I always like to listen to talks or to read papers where you really understand like how this metabolite binds to a receptor and the effect that it has afterwards. It really like demonstrates this very clearly. Absolutely.
Exactly. And because I don't have the skills to do that, then this is when the collaborators kick in. So this is teamwork.
Yes.
That's really important to keep those collaboration going.
Absolutely. So we've reached our final question. Are you ready? So what is your favorite metabolite and why?
I've got too many to choose from, but I've chosen the phenylacetate. That's the one we've been discussing today. We are starting to see a few glimpses of crosstalk between different microbial pathways and host pathways.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we're looking at the moment is this crosstalk between, I mean, phenylacetate is an aromatic amino acid microbial metabolite.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we actually saw in that first paper was that it was potentiating the use of branched-chain amino acids by the hepatocytes. So they were really using up branched-chain amino acids very efficiently. And to me, this crosstalk between pathways, between microbial and host pathways, starting with different substrates, is something that that we really want to look into over the next few years. And we're talking about one of the hallmarks of metabolic diseases, those branched-chain amino acids on the one hand,
yeah,
that are mostly seen in plasma, but also those aromatic amino acids that keep popping up in our studies as well, and not just ours, but all other people's studies. So this is, it's been shown many times.
Yeah,
that these aromatic amino acid metabolites pop up time and again with metabolic diseases. So that's something that we're looking at, and maybe follow these metabolites, because there's going to be some interesting papers in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking part in the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Metabolomist. I hope that this episode got you excited about the upcoming applications of metabolomics and that it motivated you to support science that brings a positive impact to our lives. To make sure you never miss an episode, register to our newsletter on the podcast webpage, themetabolomist.com. To learn more about metabolomics and how to plan your own projects, check out my book on metabolomic data interpretation at biocrates.com/thestoryprinciple. And don't forget to connect with me, Anisley Moussiel, on LinkedIn to continue the conversation on the many ways that metabolomics impacts health, research, and our lives.